And we are back to the reading of the Richmond Times-Dispatch for Thursday, April 25th. For the Virginia Voice, your readers are Sue Mate and Brian Keller.
We move now to opinions, to page A11, starting with this article, Call in the Carrier Pigeons. Hiking stamp prices is not going to work. And this is written by David Williams, who is president of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. It's hard to keep track of ever-increasing stamp prices. This month, the U.S. Postal Service, USPS, proposed hiking stamp prices in July from 68 cents to 73 cents, a 7.4% increase. In January, USPS hiked the price of first-class forever stamps from 66 cents to 68 cents. 6 months earlier, the agency raised prices from 63 cents to 66 cents. And 6 months before that, stamp prices increased from 60 cents to 63 cents. Postal leadership claims that these painful pricing changes are necessary to get the USPS back into the black. But, according to a new report by the nonprofit postal watchdog Keep Us Posted, this revenue-raising gamut is sorely misguided. The USPS cannot solve its dire fiscal issues by gouging hard-working taxpayers and consumers. America's mail carrier has tried and failed to use the power of mathematics to figure out pricing. For all the variables that go into the USPS's pricing equations, the agency completely misses the mark on demand elasticity. Postal bureaucrats assume that, even if the agency continues to hike prices, consumers will have no choice but to keep buying stamps at inflated rates. They are wrong. In the age of the World Wide Web and prison-bound carrier pigeons, switching away from high-priced stamps is easier than the USPS would like to believe. According to Keep Us Posted's report, under the current process, the USPS proposes new rate increases before the impact of prior increases can be fully realized. USPS demand models, which are used to justify rate increases, have never been tested in this way. USPS stands to lose considerably from miscalculating its customers' sensitivity to price. Keep Us Posted estimates that these flawed revenue projections cost the USPS $1.8 billion annually, or roughly one-third of the agency's $6.5 billion net loss for fiscal year 2023. The USPS should change its entire forecasting process and embrace greater transparency in pricing stamps. According to Keep Us Posted, every January the USPS publishes its new demand equations and documentation. In fiscal year 2024, there were 63 items in its change log. Such extensive modifications show the large degree of subjectivity when estimating the model. The USPS should at least explain why such large-scale changes are justified and how such alterations will lead to improved accuracy. Additionally, it's best practice for researchers to publish a sensitivity analysis showing how changes in forecast design, i.e., which variables are included and excluded, can lead to different results. The USPS has failed to explain this, and as a result, researchers have little insight into the strengths and weaknesses of the postal forecasting process. Most importantly, America's mail carrier should finally admit that stamp price hikes are not effective for raising revenue. Instead of trying to squeeze more revenue out of taxpayers and consumers, the USPS should take a second look at its costly spending and discounting programs. One problematic program is the Workshare Discount Initiative. Each year, the USPS showers $15 billion worth of discounts on private businesses that perform mailing-related work, e.g. pre-sorting and barcoding mail, on behalf of the USPS. The basic idea of farming out postal operations and allowing private players to pocket the savings is a solid one, but only if the postage discounts correspond to actual savings. Even though nearly 90% of market-dominant mail, i.e. letters and marketing mail, is work-shared, the USPS Office of the Inspector General has found documented savings to be sorely lacking. According to a February 2024 IG report, the USPS does not have detailed procedures that document responsibilities for calculating avoided costs and work share discounts for first-class mail and marketing mail letters and enable management to effectively monitor those control activities. In addition, the USPS fails to regularly monitor data inputs that go into its work share discount pricing models. In other words, the USPS is asking taxpayers and consumers to take a leap of faith and trust that it is properly extending $15 billion in discounts based on mailing companies saving the USPS money. The USPS needs to figure out a better way to get on firmer fiscal footing. Reassessing workshare savings is a far more promising option than perpetually raising stamp prices. Postal consumers shouldn't have to mull over carrier pigeons to get their letters and cards delivered. And that opinion piece was Call In the Carrier Pigeons. Hiking stamp prices is not going to work. Written by David Williams, who is the president of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Brian?
Thanks, Sue. Our next opinion piece comes from the pen of Jeff Shapiro, who writes for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And his opinion piece today is titled, The Selling of Abigail Spamberger, Offering Something for Everyone. Virginia Democrats are falling in line and falling in love. With LeVar Stoney's strategic retreat, rather than risk a pasting for the 2025 gubernatorial nomination, he's risking a pasting for the 2024 lieutenant governor's nomination, Democrats are foregoing a contest for their top spot to rally behind Abigail Spanberger, whose politics and posturing seem to give almost everyone in a party still whining over Glenn Youngkin's squeaker victory in 2021 something to cheer about. Beyond discouraging polling and even more discouraging fundraising, Stoney's gubernatorial ambitions were a casualty of his overambition as a 40-something who's worked only in politics, even when he wasn't. The Richmond mayoralty, which Stoney twice won by plurality in 2016 and 2020, is proving for him what it was for his predecessors since the city returned to a popularly elected chief executive in 2004, a dead-end job. It's not that the majority-minority city is ungovernable, it's that its problems, including grinding enduring poverty that contrasts sharply with its glittery youthful vibe, are confounding and interrelated. They're made more so by a continuing conflict over where mayoral authority ends and councilmanic authority begins. A tax base limited by the seemingly unlimited and tax-exempt presence of state government, and the blame reflexively affixed to whomever's mayor because, when it comes to local government, residents don't care about politics and personalities. They want to know streets are safe and clean, schools work, and that bureaucrats at City Hall can untie knots, often of their own making. Stoney also wasn't helped by the company he keeps. As a protege of Terry McAuliffe, Stoney, unfairly or not, was a convenient substitute target for Democrats relitigating the ever-ebullient Macker's slender loss to Youngkin for a second non-consecutive term as governor. That fed Democrats' appetite for a fresh face and one who's demonstrated, as Spanberger has over three terms in Congress since defeating a MAGA incumbent in the anti-Trump tsunami of 2018, an ability to simultaneously engage voters, friendly and hostile. Spanberger, having established bases in the vote-rich, blue-trending Richmond and Northern Virginia suburbs, checks lots of boxes. For those who are certain politics has an enduring see-me side, she's been pushing restrictions on stock trading by members of Congress. For those angry over expensive prescription drugs, she's been an advocate for price caps. For those convinced congressional Democrats are captive to the left, she opposed Nancy Pelosi for House Speaker. As a pistol-packing U.S. Postal Service inspector and later a CIA operative, she's not exactly a wimp on firearms. As the only Virginian on the House Agriculture Committee, and in its Democratic minority to boot, she watches out for the countryside, never mind that most of it is wedged into Republican districts whose representatives seem more concerned about God, gays, and guns. And don't underestimate the lift Spanberger gets from the call of history. Virginia has yet to elect a woman as governor. To borrow a term popular in swinging 1920s London and Hollywood, Spanberger is the it girl. New, clever, a source of curiosity. Currently, 12 states and one U.S. territory have female governors, 9 Democrats and 4 Republicans. 49 women have become governors since the first was elected nearly 100 years ago. Virginia has breached the racial redoubt, installing the first elective black governor in 1989, and 3 times electing people of color as lieutenant governor. That includes the incumbent, Republican Winsome Earle Sears, herself considering a run for governor that could make her the first woman elected to the job. Should Earle Sears be her party's nominee next year, she'll have to get past Attorney General Jason Meares, the first Hispanic person elected statewide in Virginia. It raises the intriguing prospect of a 2-woman contest in a southern state between a black Republican and a white Democrat. To entice election-deciding independents, both work assiduously to blur the crisp distinctions demanded by contemporary either-or politics. Earle Sears, whose handlers have been circulating since late March, friendly polling that shows her stronger among Republican activists than Meares, wants the GOP to move on from former President Donald Trump, though she stands firm on such Trumpy non-negotiables for her party, such as gun rights. It's a stance illustrated by that widely circulated photo of Earle Sears, a former Marine, brandishing a military-style rifle. That 19 months before Virginians choose their next governor, Democrats have, in Spanberger, a putative nominee who is well-financed and widely supported, may instill a measure of panic among members of both parties, fearing that the primaries will needlessly burn cash and leave losers and their voters feeling burned. Thus, Democrats might press for consensus candidates for lieutenant governor and attorney general. Republicans conceivably have all 3 statewide nominations to settle, should Earle Sears and Meares battle for the gubernatorial perch. But neither party should fear competition, recognizing that the perils, notwithstanding, primaries are tools for enlisting and energizing voters and testing and refining ideas. In 1985, a bitter and lengthy fight for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination between Lieutenant Governor Dick Davis and Attorney General Jerry Belisle's, it was decided by caucus and convention, the equivalent of hand-to-hand trench warfare, dispirited activists. But Belisle's went on to lead a Democratic sweep, winning by 110,000 votes and carrying every congressional district. Nearly 40 years on, Spanberger is likened by some to Belisle's, sharing a serious, no-nonsense approach to policy, a surprising wit and knack for functioning comfortably in a variety of settings. That she speaks several languages, including Spanish, allows her to campaign among new Virginians in their preferred tongue. And in 2021, Youngkin, an unknown political rookie whose Croesus wealth accumulated on Wall Street allowed him to become known in a hurry, turned back six opponents for the Republican nomination, including a former House Speaker, in drive-through caucuses during the coronavirus pandemic. Excitement over Youngkin's surprise victory spilled into the general election fight with McAuliffe, who, even Democrats acknowledged, ran as a retread, more interested in talking about what he did as Virginia's 72nd governor than what he would do as its 74th. For Youngkin, Republicans, desperate to end their statewide losing streak, quickly fell in line. Almost 4 years later, it's not clear they fell in love. That opinion piece, written by Jeff E. Shapiro for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, was titled "The Selling of Abigail Spanberger, Offering Something for Everyone." Sue?
Thank you, Brian. We turn now to letters to the editor, and we have two of them, beginning with Cheryl Myers Johnson's letter of Midlothian. Youngkin should sign green energy financing bill. This year, Virginia lawmakers advanced measures to promote cleaner air, lower energy costs, and foster economic growth, efforts that will create jobs and attract clean energy investment. Governor Glenn Youngkin has been presented with an opportunity to sign into law several policies within his energy plan, which calls for expanding distributed solar power, cutting energy costs, and leveraging federal energy investment. A crucial policy to achieve these goals is the Virginia Clean Energy Innovation Bank, which will free up billions of dollars of federal funding under the Inflation Reduction Act. Introduced by Senate Majority Leader Scott Surovell, this legislation passed out of the General Assembly with bipartisan support. However, Youngkin amended the legislation, Senate Bill 729, to delay by at least a year our state's ability to seize on unprecedented federal clean energy grants and funding. This move undermines our state's ability to harness resources, cultivate well-compensated employment opportunities in the clean energy sector, and ensure a sustainable energy future for Virginia. The Senate rejected the governor's amendment last week. Upon implementation, the initiative is poised to yield extensive benefits for the state. It will expedite the development of clean energy technologies and projects aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions, expanding access to new markets, and empowering historically marginalized communities. Moreover, it will serve as a catalyst for accessing billions of dollars in federal funding. This bipartisan policy will purify our air, create good-paying jobs, lower electric bills, and secure a cleaner energy future. Governor Youngkin should act now. And that letter, "Youngkin Should Sign Green Energy Financing Bill," was written by Cheryl Myers Johnson of Midlothian. Our next letter is from Doug Burford of Richmond. "Let's be proud of our hometown. Instead of telling the world about all the sad things that are happening in our town, let's start talking about the good things. Here's my first attempt. Richmond is home to many things, thanks to Patrick Henry, who gave us liberty. But the most incredible things we do are never mentioned. We are the world's leader in saving children. We're the home of Child Fund International that has helped millions of children around the world have a better life. We're the home of Sheltering Arms, whose advancements help children who have been seriously hurt recover. We're the home of Child Savers in Church Hill, whose volunteers work wonders with children who have been abused and neglected. We're the home of the Children's Tower, whose doctors and nurses at the Children's Hospital of Richmond at VCU are recognized for going beyond to save a child. In fact, Richmond is the home of 100 organizations that help children. So, the next time someone asks about Richmond, tell them about our children, our great universities, our world-class chefs, and our crazy squirrels." And that letter was "Let's Be Proud of Our Hometown," written by Doug Burford of Richmond. And that concludes our letters to the editor for today.
Thank you, Sue. We move back to page A4 for some more news. This article is titled, Four More Arrests in Sexting at Massage Parlors. This is written by Samuel B. Parker for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Chesterfield County Police on Wednesday announced four additional arrests and charges in an ongoing investigation into sexually illicit massage businesses authorities say are linked to a Chinese criminal organization that uses slave labor. Nine people, eight of whom came from Flushing, New York, now have been charged in connection with the probe since it was announced in late February. And the problem is not limited to Chesterfield, Lieutenant Edward Pierpoint told the Richmond Times-Dispatch. It is tied to a broader commercial human trafficking ring along the East Coast. It's a national problem, Pierpoint said. It's happening in Henrico and in Richmond. The latest arrests in Chesterfield came Monday when officers conducted undercover operations at Massage for You, located at 1710 East 100 Road, and International Spa, located at 247 East 100 Road. A masseuse at each location offered to perform illicit sexual acts for additional pay, police said. Officers arrested Huayan Zhang, 44, Qian Zhang, 42, at Massage for You, and Yuan Zhang, 41, and Qihong Yan, 58, at International Spa. All four women are from Flushing, New York, according to police. Huayan and Qian Zhang are sisters, police said, and currently live in Chester. Qian Zhang is the owner of Massage for You. Huayan Zhang has been charged with prostitution, keeping or residing in a bawdy place, and performing a massage without proper permitting, according to court records. She is next scheduled to appear in court on June 25th. Qian Zhang has been charged with keeping or residing in a bawdy place and permitting massages without proper permitting. Her next court date could not immediately be determined. Yuan Zhang has been charged with prostitution and keeping or residing in a bawdy place. She is next scheduled to appear in court on Monday. Qihong Yan has been charged with performing a massage without proper permitting. She is next scheduled to appear in court on Monday. Massage parlors are not the only businesses involved, Pierpont said. The victims who travel to the U.S. also end up in other industries, such as food service. Pierpont could not say how many trafficking victims are believed to be working at Chesterfield businesses. Pierpont said the victims are often hesitant to come forward due to fear of retribution. Another complicating factor is that many of the victims are shuttled from place to place, making it difficult to track them, he said. They will stay in one place for a few days or weeks before being taken to another location. Virginia today, New York tomorrow, maybe North Carolina next week, Pierpont said. He added that Chesterfield police have been careful to share details related to the investigation with the public in order to protect residents from sexual assault or harassment and to signal to the suspects that they will be arrested if they continue. The FBI and Virginia State Police are assisting in the effort, he said. Chesterfield Police Captain Richard McCullough previously told the Times-Dispatch that the illicit sexual services offered at the businesses could be related to human trafficking, adding that the fact that many of the suspects came from Flushing is not a coincidence. Flushing appears to be a common nexus, McCullough said, where people will arrive from outside the country, perhaps obtain a massage therapy license, and be transported by a courier from New York to Virginia. McCullough said that in some cases the individuals involved report that they don't want to be there, they're not allowed to leave, and they're being forced to perform these acts. Police on February 26th arrested Yume Yang, 49, at Golden Finger Massage, and Lan Ying Lisa Sun, 52, at Touchpoint Massage, after they allegedly offered to perform illicit sexual acts for additional pay. And on March 8th, officers arrested Jinlan Yao, 61, of Flushing, Zhizhong Zhang, 52, of Flushing, and Fang Wang, 57, of Chesterfield, all of whom were employed by Ocean Spa, located at 9935 Hull Street Road, after a masseuse at the business allegedly offered an undercover detective sexual acts for an additional cost. Chesterfield police have been looking into this for years, McCullough said. The tips have come from a variety of sources, he said, but declined to specify how detectives had learned of the illicit practices. That article, from page A4, was titled Four More Arrests in Sex Sting at Massage Parlors, and it was written by Samuel B. Parker for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And with that, we're going to take our next break. We will be back in a moment with today's obituaries and more news as time allows. Please stick with us.